Welcome, everyone, to the Asia Unbound podcast. I'm Liz Economy, and today I'm delighted to welcome Dr. John Curtis Perry, who was the Henry Willard Dennison Professor of History at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. Dr. Perry is also the author of a wonderful new book, Singapore, Unlikely Power, published by Oxford University Press. Welcome, Dr. Perry.
Thank you very much, Liz. It's a delight to be with you.
So, John, your title says a lot. Singapore is indeed an unlikely power. Its neighborhood is filled with countries that boast a wealth of natural resources and human capital, such as Burma, Indonesia, and Malaysia. Yet Singapore, with its tiny population and no real natural resources to speak of, has vaulted past them all economically. Why is this?
Well, Singapore is truly a remarkably vital community. It's a fraction the size of Rhode Island. And yet, I think the answer is complex, of course. Its location is superb. It's on the Malacca Straits, which is where a major part of world shipping passes annually. I'd say the Malacca Straits are now more strategic even than the English Channel. And Singapore, with a superb harbor sheltered from typhoon, is an ideal place for a maritime city to grow and prosper. And Singapore is a very old place, actually, although most people don't think of it as such. It has a history of 700 years when it was important as a Malay maritime center. And that disappeared. Early Singapore was swallowed up by the jungle, and nothing much happened there until the British arrived in 1819 and created a colony there. So, location matters, but it's not everything, of course. It's what you do with it. And I think Singapore's unique combination of Chinese entrepreneurial skill and British political stability created a marriage of convenience that really launched Singapore's success in the 19th century as a modern maritime city-state. And today, of course, it's the only maritime city-state in the world. But one reason I was drawn to study Singapore is, being a maritime historian, I had looked carefully at the great maritime city-states of the past, such as Mediterranean, Venice, Genoa, in the Baltic, Lübeck, and Danzig, and the Hanseatic League. All these were small places which exercised a major impact far beyond their confines as tiny cities. They were of regional importance, but Singapore has carried this into the new dimension. Singapore is a global presence. It's now, of course, one of the richest nations in the world.
And I want to come back to, you know, why Singapore matters today and why we in the United States should care about Singapore.
Yeah.
But let me take you back a little bit, because your book does such a terrific job of exploring the history of Singapore and bringing it to life. Back to the late 1860s and early 1870s, when you identify three transformative events that I think you argue really set Singapore on its unique path. Talk to us about those.
Sure. Well, one of those things was the opening of the Suez Canal, which cut the distance dramatically between Western Europe, namely Britain, the mother country, and what they call the Far East. It was far closer with the canal than it was using the old Cape Route, which the Portuguese were the first to sail around, and which was the only way of reaching that part of the world from Europe until the canal was cut through the Isthmus of Suez in 1869. That was really a major date in world transportation history. Also, coincidentally, the opening of the North American Transcontinental Railroad. So the Suez Canal, also steam power. Steam power was a revolutionary phenomenon in maritime history, changed so much in the way of introducing dependability, scheduling to shipping, which was so important to the economic life of the era. And in addition to steam power, one also had the electric telegraph in its submarine function, the undersea cable, which revolutionized communications. For the first time in the world, communication could have almost immediate by cable, as opposed to by letter, carried by ship or other means. So that immediately enhanced the importance of Singapore. And also another factor was that Singapore became a crown colony and shed its affiliation with the East India Company, which disappears. And Singapore was no longer alone, but it was linked in a somewhat peculiar marriage with Malacca and Penang on the Asian mainland. But it gave Singapore, in the so-called Straits Settlements, a foothold on the continent, which it had not had previously. So those big phenomena were of immense importance, all related to what I call oceanic revolution. As a maritime historian, I think the concept of revolution is a way of structuring the modern maritime past, that is, over the last 500 years, if you can call that modern. First, oceanic revolution was the opening up of the world ocean by the Portuguese and the Spaniards and others, the recapture of the New World as part of the human experience. And then in the 19th century comes the second phase of oceanic revolution, which I was just alluded to in terms of transportation and communication via the sea. And then the third oceanic revolution is coincident with Singapore's life as an independent state, and that is the development of nuclear power, which would be important for propulsion of submarines. That didn't have much impact on Singapore, of course, but it affected the global strategic picture. But more important was the simple invention of the standardized steel box, the container, which Singapore capitalized upon very soon after the box emerged in the 1950s. Singapore saw the advantages to developing a port that could accommodate this new means of rationalizing the transport of goods. So that also coinciding with the bulk carrier, which the super ship, which was particularly important for carrying resources like oil, also played into Singaporean hands, because Singapore became a major bunkering port, a place where ships could refuel, and that remains important even today. Singapore's oil business is important, although Singapore doesn't consume oil itself in any quantity. It handles a great deal, which it transships to other consumers.
So these really important technological as well as structural factors that sort of shaped Singapore's opportunities, and Singapore took advantage of these in important ways. But I think what also your book does so very well is to identify some really interesting figures in Singapore's history that also played an outsized role in determining the development path of the country. Which one or two figures in Singapore's history do you think particularly shaped the country's evolution?
Well, I suggest that there are two that were particularly important. One was the so-called founder, Raffles, Sir Stamford Raffles. And he was in the early 19th century, around 1815, when he and others established Singapore. They decided that was the best site for a trading post, our route to China. And the second figure would be the great transformer, Lee Kuan Yew, the late founding prime minister. And I was attracted to both of them, not simply because as individuals they are interesting, but also because of their use of history. They saw history as being of value to them in creating an image of the city over which, in the case of Raffles, Raffles was a student of Malay history, and he proclaimed that he saw in Singapore the ruins of a very important place, namely a Malay trading state of some 700 years before. Everyone scoffed because the evidence was very slim. But he saw this as a way of justifying his vision of what Singapore was and should be, namely an important trading post and a focus for activity along the Malacca Straits, linking the Indian Ocean and that world with the world Pacific. And although people scoffed at the time, he adhered to the belief, and now contemporary archaeology is justifying what he claimed. Namely, they are finding through shipwrecks and other sources materials indicating that Raffles was probably right, that in fact Singapore does have a history that stretches back so many centuries, and it's not just a British creation in the 19th century. Now, Lee Kuan Yew, the founding prime minister, had a similar interest in using history. In this case, he used Raffles as an icon of Singaporean rise, Raffles as a symbol of British law, order, and attachment to free trade and to relationships with a wider world than the region. He saw that Raffles and the British could be useful in a city which was three quarters Chinese but had major groups of others, particularly the Malays and the Indians, who are very sensitive to their rights. And Raffles seemed to Lee Kuan Yew to be a convenient icon, sort of transcending those ethnic differences, which have been a real problem for modern Singapore because of this diversity and intensity of feeling, different languages, different cultures, and so forth. How to hold all this together has been the continuing struggle and tension for the Singaporean government.
And how did Lee Kuan Yew manage to do that? What were sort of the central elements of Lee Kuan Yew's leadership?
As a leader, of course, he was extremely authoritarian, and he had a firm sense of what he wanted to do. He was highly ambitious. Even in the first years of this new state, he said Singapore should become the New York of Southeast Asia. So his ambitions were very great. He had the ability to identify able lieutenants, and some of the people who worked for him, whom I describe in the book, were extraordinarily talented. But Lee always was on top. At the very beginning, he would say, "I am the captain of the team." And everyone deferred to him because he commanded respect for the sharpness of his intellect and the sharpness of his tongue. He was very articulate, and he was quick to establish a reputation of authority and competence. And training of people has been very, very important in the Singaporean experience, I think. Identifying people of talent, putting them through a series of examinations. The top ones were usually and are usually sent abroad. It was my privilege at Fletcher to teach some of these people who became important figures, the government. And also, Singapore, I think, has paid close attention to the numeracy and literacy of the working force. So it's not simply an education of the elite, but it's a general educational system. I just recently read that Singapore has become quite interested in continuing education. They are actually subsidizing programs making this possible, which is something I think that we could take note of. I, being an elderly person, have a personal interest.
Well, also, you're not only educating yourself, but you're educating a lot of other people through your work still, so.
Well, I hope so. Will anybody read my book?
Well, I certainly did it. I'm certainly going to recommend it to everybody because it really is a terrific and engaging read. It also seems, I think, as we look at contemporary Singapore, that they've been very successful in innovating, right, and modernizing and recognizing
Absolutely.
Sort of niches. So talk to us a little bit about, you know, how Singapore has become a leader
Sure.
in certain areas.
Well, Singapore is highly pragmatic. And from the very start of its independence, it reached out for guidance from others. Israel was an important model especially for the military. But Singaporeans were attracted to the notion of similarity there. Israel, a small dot in a potentially hostile, if not actually hostile, sea, with Singapore in the same situation in its part of the world. So that was very important. And reaching out also to experts like Albert Winsemius, whom I talk about in the book. He was a Hollander, an economist, but also a shipping man. And he came to Singapore as part of a UN mission in the early 1960s and developed a strong interest in Singapore. And the Dutch experience seemed applicable because, of course, the Netherlands is a maritime society also, although on a much bigger scale than Singapore. But there were similarities there that I think attracted the Singaporeans. And Winsemius came to think of himself actually as Singaporean. And more recently, Singapore has made an effort to attract innovative people to come and do their work there. So they're very good about providing laboratories and research stipends and so forth that are attractive to scholars from overseas. I've met a number of them. I remember a Finnish biologist who came because of the working conditions and the pleasant living environment that Singapore offers. So he's one of many. And Singapore is now pushing in interesting directions. Pharmaceuticals, for example, medical research is very strong. And the goal is the nation that is using the most advanced technologies to bind the society together. And the Singaporeans realize they have to keep moving. It's not enough to enjoy their current success and their comfortable standard of living. They have a high sense of anxiety and vulnerability, which comes from their size and their situation and their dependence upon factors beyond their control. The state of the world market, for example. The swing away from globalization could be quite hurtful to Singapore. There is a continuing vitality, a commitment to keep things moving. I think it's actualized in shipping, in the intensity, the speed of handling cargo and keeping those containers moving. The internet has also been a positive factor, helping Singapore keep on top. And Singapore is one of the world's three largest seaports.
Yeah, and I think in some respects, the very fact of Singapore's size, in some ways, its natural disadvantages have made it all the more innovative, as you suggest. And I think one of the interesting cases that you talk about in the book that I really found fascinating was how Singapore has dealt with the issue of water. And I think that's a really sort of interesting case.
Yes. Well, Singapore does not itself produce enough water. There's not enough natural water to satisfy the thirst of its citizens. So they've turned to desalinization. But more interestingly, I think, is what they call new water, which is reprocessed used water sewage, essentially. And they have developed a process which makes it cleaner than the water that people would normally drink through normal processes of cleanliness. So Singapore hopes, in fact, to develop its technology to the extent that it'll be attractive to other states because they know that water is going to be increasingly a problem throughout the planet. And they want to be able to take advantage of it. And the ideal, of course, is to make Singapore as self-sufficient as it can be in terms of the use of this resource. Buying it from Malaysia, as they have been in the past, is convenient but not cheap, and it heightens a sense of vulnerability. Supposing the Malays want to cut off the taps, what happens then? So they want to avoid that kind of situation.
Yeah, it was a really, really interesting discussion, I think, that you portrayed in the book. Yeah,
food, too. You know, they only grow about 9 or 10% of what they eat. Virtually everything is imported, but they are doing a lot with rooftop gardens and innovation in terms of hydroponics on a considerable scale and so forth. In other words, paying attention to the possibilities that can be provided if you use space imaginatively. And they're digging underground to create space for activities that might as well be subsurface rather than on top of the surface. Land being the most valuable resource in Singapore because of the small size. They're trying to use their land as imaginatively and fruitfully as possible in all respects. So manufacturing is conducted in high-rise structures, which is unusual. And that's evidence, I think, of this imaginative use of space.
Yeah, I think we could learn a lot from Singapore, frankly.
Exactly.
Looking at these issues, in particular water and food. But let me then ask you one last question, and that is, does Singapore have a developmental model that you think others can emulate? And what should be the takeaway for the United States from your book?
Well, I don't think Singapore is a model, first of all. It's unique. And it's really fun and interesting to hear people talk about wanting to be another Singapore. Panama wants to be the Singapore of Central America. Even Rwanda wants to be the Singapore of Central Africa.
China wants to be Singapore in many respects.
Yes. Yeah, China studies Singapore very carefully. In fact, the Chinese are translating my book. I'm very pleased.
That's great.
So Singapore, however, is unique. Talk about Singapore on the Thames, as some British are. It's really quite ridiculous because of the differences. Singapore is what it is. But there are lessons. I think, first of all, investment in education and the quality of teachers. And I mentioned continuing education earlier. And attention to infrastructure. Singapore is rebuilding constantly, and it's part of this sense of motion that the economy has. Greening is another lesson I think that we could take. That is landscaping, making for an attractive environment. Lee Kuan Yew put a lot of money into growing trees and flowers in public spaces to enhance the beauty of the Singaporean landscape because Lee Kuan Yew wanted to attract foreign investment. He saw foreign investment as necessary for a manufacturing sector that would provide jobs. The port was great, but it didn't have enough jobs for what was required for the society. So manufacturing was the answer, and Singaporeans traveled abroad. Lee Kuan Yew came to the United States. He went to Japan also, as did others, seeking out foreign investment, and they achieved great success. As I point out in the book, one of the reasons why we Americans should be so interested in Singapore is that we have so much money invested there. We have more money invested in Singapore than we have in Japan. We have more money invested in Singapore than we have in Australia. We have twice as much money invested in Singapore than we have in all of China.
That is astonishing.
Isn't that astonishing?
It really is.
And there's some 700 companies, American companies, with a presence in Singapore now. Something like 27,000 Americans are living and working in Singapore. So it's a considerable financial interest to us. But also, one shouldn't neglect the military. It's not only monetary, but military. We are allowed to use the great bases that the British created and the Singaporeans have retained on the island, the naval base and also air bases, which are used now for our new combat littoral ships. They're going to be based there permanently, four of them, I believe. And also it can accommodate the big, giant American aircraft carrier. This is very important, particularly since we don't have Subic Bay anymore in the Philippines. We don't have any base in Southeast Asia. So Singapore is an important anchor for American security.
Absolutely. So I think for anybody, not just the interested lay reader, but also for our policymakers, I think your book is a really important testament and help in understanding why this country matters to the United States. So let me thank you so much, because I think you've written a very big book about a very small country, and helped us to understand why Singapore is important and an unlikely power, as you put it. So thank you very much for taking the time to chat with us today.
Well, my great pleasure. Thank you very much for the opportunity. I love talking about this subject.